Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science. Our lead story today concerns Japan. The Prime Minister of Japan, after first stating that he's going to back nuclear power in that country, did an about-face, a U-turn, and he made a historic decision not to go ahead with the nuclear option. This is big news because it could affect the proliferation of nuclear power throughout Asia and maybe even Europe. And speaking about the Fukushima disaster, scientists have been able to get a little bit of access into the site as workers make probes. That is, they take baby steps going into the reactor site, and the damage is much worse than expected. So in other words, we have a ticking time bomb with the Fukushima reactor. And speaking about outer space, there's an asteroid out there that for the first time in history has given us advance warning of a flyby. On November 8th, an asteroid about 1,300 feet across, about the size of an aircraft carrier, is going to go whizzing right by the distance between the Earth and the Moon. And scientists are eagerly awaiting that close encounter with radar and infrared sensors to map the surface of the asteroid. Thank goodness the asteroid's not going to hit, or else it would be a city buster capable of wiping out New York or Los Angeles. And then we're going to bring on our special guest today. Our special guest today is Patrick Tucker of the World Future Society, an organization that looks into the future. The future of robots, medicine, computers, artificial intelligence, the future of, well, basically everything. So in this hour of exploration, we're going to talk about the future. In fact, my book, Physics of the Future, is about the next 100 years in technology and science and how it's going to affect our daily lives. And the book has been on the New York Times bestseller list for over a month now, and we're going to offer it as a premium to various community and public radio stations that carry Exploration. So once again, the book is called Physics of the Future. It talks about your future, jobs, medicine, what's the economy is going to look like, how will we live, how will we communicate with each other into the coming decades, as told to me by 300 of the world's top scientists that I've interviewed for BBC Television, the Discovery Channel, the Science Channel, and of course, Exploration. Well, let's begin talking about the situation in Japan. The Japanese government for a generation has said that its future is tied to nuclear energy. Eventually, they said 50% of the electricity in Japan would come from nuclear power plants. And now, because of the Fukushima disaster, the Japanese government has done an about-face, a U-turn, even as just last week they said they're still committed to nuclear energy. No, they're not. Instead of going from 30% to 50% dependency on nuclear energy, they're basically going to call a moratorium on the building of new nuclear power plants. This is also in the wake of the Prime Minister's declaration that the Hamaoka nuclear power plant should be shut down. Now realize that no matter how bad the Fukushima disaster was, Fukushima is in northern Japan, where it's mainly countryside. If you saw pictures of the area, you see cows, you see farm animals, not that many people. However, when you go south, then you hit the bulk of the Japanese population. And if you go even further south, you go to the Mount Fuji area, where we have the Hamaoka nuclear power plant, which is definitely closer to a large metropolitan area. And in fact, if that plant were to go up in smoke, you're talking about evacuating Tokyo, which is one of the most heavily populated cities on the planet Earth. Impossible, many people say. 13 million people in metropolitan Tokyo. And that's why the Japanese government has made an about turn, stating that they're not going to go ahead with a plan to go 50% nuclear. They're going to begin the process of shutting down, at least temporarily, the Hamaoka nuclear power plant and looking at alternatives to nuclear. And speaking about the Fukushima reactor site, scientists are now taking baby steps baby steps to get the first peek at the damage of the core, using robots and workers that can only go in for about 10 minutes at a time. That's how radioactive the field is at Fukushima, where we have near lethal amounts of radiation. Based on these little snippets of information, scientists and engineers are trying to assess, well, how bad is that nuclear accident? Much worse than previously thought. First of all, the pumps at the reactor site are not operational. They're broken down, which means that we have to use handheld hoses. We have to use outside means of pumping water into the core. Then the water seems to be dropping. Water level gauges that for the first time can be read by humans and robots show that the water levels are actually below the top of the core. Believe it or not, the cores are still exposed, meaning that probably the top part of the core has already crumbled as a consequence of heating up to 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit, the melting point of uranium dioxide. This also means there's a leak someplace. Somewhere, water is leaking out. Even as they dump more water on the top, water is leaking out from the bottom. That's really bad news. First of all, because, of course, you have more radioactive water, what are you going to do with that water? Just last month, they dumped some of that radioactive water into the ocean and caused a stir, a storm of protest from Korea and China as a consequence. So what are they going to do with that radioactive water as it leaks out? But more important, it means that the core might have created a breach of containment. In other words, there's a crack or there's a hole in the containment structure. So when water comes in, water goes out. And that's the reason why the reactors are bleeding water. And that's one of the reasons why they still have not been able to control that disaster. 6 to 9 months, they say, before they can even stabilize the reactor by turning on the automatic pumps. This means that Fukushima is still a ticking time bomb. A small earthquake, a pipe break, and water is lost. With the loss of cooling water, you have the potential of a meltdown, this time at 3 nuclear power plants, making an accident worse than Chernobyl. So let's keep our fingers crossed. However, it's a race against time. Also, in outer space, astronomers have been elated by the fact that for the first time in history, they have an advance warning of a giant asteroid that's going to come whizzing by the Earth, in fact, right between the Earth and the Moon. The asteroid is 1,300 feet across, about the size of an aircraft carrier. Initial sightings of the reactor showed that it's pretty much spherical in shape. If it were to hit the Earth, it would be a city buster, capable of knocking out New York or Paris or London, like what hit Siberia back in 1908. Now, what's novel about this is that in 2005, astronomers first began to notice this asteroid. Then, since April of 2010, astronomers have been tracking it with the Arecibo radio telescope in Puerto Rico. And that's how we know so much about its potential trajectory on November 8th of this year. In the wee hours of the morning, if you're lucky, you'll see a dim star go whizzing right overhead, and that is an asteroid. As a consequence, scientists are readying a barrage of sensors. We're talking about radar, infrared, all sorts of ways of scanning the surface of that asteroid. We're going to have a flyby comparable to a flyby with our space probes, except this time the space probe is the Earth. The Earth itself is a space probe as we make a close encounter with an asteroid. And then later on, we're going to bring on a special guest today. He's Patrick Tucker of the World Futurist Society, senior editor of the magazine, The Futurist. And the future is the topic of today's exploration. My latest book, Physics of the Future, is about the science, not the science fiction, the science behind the prototypes, the therapies, the gizmos, the gadgets, which are going to change everything around us. The wealth of nations, jobs, medicine, all of that is going to change, and all of it is documented in my book, Physics of the Future. And it's a New York Times bestseller right now. And we're going to offer it as a premium to various community and public radio stations that carry exploration. And so once again, the book is not just a sneak preview into the future, it's also a way to raise funds to keep your radio station alive and well. But when I interviewed over 300 of the world's top scientists, they talked about gadgets, therapies, new inventions, which are dazzling, some of them just 10 to 15 years away. For example, we'll have the internet in our contact lens. So we simply blink, and then we go online. These contact lenses will also recognize people's faces. It'll have face recognition technology. So if you're at a cocktail party and you don't know who the important people are, in the future, you'll know exactly who to suck up to. And then, if they happen to speak Chinese or German to you, your contact lens will translate what they say and print out subtitles underneath their image. Now, if you're an artist, you'll love these contact lenses because you wave your hands and you'll create all sorts of works of art just by moving your fingertips. If you're an architect, you'll be able to rearrange the towers of your skyscrapers, saving you an enormous amount of tedious work. And of course, the first people to get in line to buy these internet contact lenses will be college students studying for final examinations. All they will have to do is blink, and they can see all the answers to their final exam. And so it means that we professors are going to have to stress concepts and principles rather than tedious memorization that you could simply look up in your internet contact lens. Also, chips will be leaving the computer and going into household appliances. Chips will cost about a penny in about 10 years' time. That's cheaper than scrap paper. And when a chip goes into a typewriter, it becomes a word processor. When a chip goes into a telephone, it becomes a cell phone. When a chip goes into a TV set, it becomes the internet. And now we're going to put chips everywhere around us. We're going to put chips into wallpaper. You realize that we can now make plastic transistors? With plastic transistors, we can now make wallpaper that is intelligent. Every dot on the wallpaper is connected to a plastic transistor. This is called OLED technology. And so redecorating will never be so simple. You simply talk to the wall and ask it to redecorate. And because the wall is intelligent, you can also conjure up images. For example, RoboDoctor. We have the potential of putting an animated doctor that looks pretty close to a human in your wall, and it'll make house calls anytime, day or night. 95% of all common questions will be answered by RoboDoc in the wall, reducing the cost of healthcare. RoboLawyer may also be put in your wall so that you can get all sorts of legal advice simply by talking to the wall. And also, if you're lonely on Friday night, you'll go to the wall screen and say, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's available tonight?" Well, your wall screen already knows the kind of person you like to date, will contact all the other people who are lonely and staring in front of their wall screen and set up a date for you. And then you'll go out, see a movie maybe, come back, and then say, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, we want to see the movie Casablanca." Except remove Humphrey Bogart's face and put my face instead. Remove Ingrid Bergman's face and put my date's face instead. And then when you get in a car, the car will literally drive itself. The Pentagon has already perfected a driverless car. It has GPS sensors to locate its position. It also has radar in the fenders, and it's actually safer than a human. So we can simply relax and let the car navigate around the interstate or even do shopping in Midtown, because that's how precise these driverless cars are. And then on the medical front, when you use the toilet, your toilet will be intelligent and tell you that you have cancer growing inside your body. DNA chips, complements of Silicon Valley, are so precise now. They, in principle, can pick up proteins emitted from individual cancer cells in a cancer colony 10 years before cancer forms. You know that Aretha Franklin and Steve Jobs of Apple, they have pancreatic cancer. It's very aggressive, they say, and inevitably kills you. Well, people have sequenced the genes of pancreatic cancer and found out that the mythology is all wrong. That cancer is slow growing. In fact, it grows over a 20-year period. Only in the last few years do you feel it, and then you go to the doctor, and the doctor tells you it's too late, you have an aggressive, fatal cancer growing inside your body. Well, in the future, your toilet will tell you that you have 20 years to take care of this problem. You have a few hundred cancer cells growing in your body, and we will use nanoparticles to zero in like smart bombs to take out cancer. So in other words, medicine is going to be turned upside down into the future. Also, body parts will be grown. You realize that already today we can grow cartilage, noses, ears, skin, blood vessels, heart valves. The first bladder was grown 4 years ago. The first windpipe was grown last year, again from your own cells, so there's no rejection mechanism. And in 5 years' time, perhaps the first liver will be grown. So in other words, we're going to have a human body shop when it comes to being able to regenerate organs as they wear out. And this means that we're also in the process of extending the human lifespan. Well, in the book, Physics of the Future, I make literally hundreds of predictions, and I'm not a science fiction writer. I'm a hard-nosed physicist, and I want prototypes. I want demonstrations. I don't want someone's press release. I want proof that their device is going to work, that their device is going to change history. And that's why I wrote the book, Physics of the Future, because most people don't know what's happening in the laboratory. And you'll be shocked to find that much of what you see in the science fiction movies is actually being worked on by real reputable physicists. Do you know that shape-shifting, something which we saw in Terminator 2 with that robot that could literally melt its way through any obstacle? There are scientists working on that. In fact, I took a film crew to Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh and actually photographed prototypes of a technology which may eventually give us shape-shifting. Once again, our special guest today is Patrick Tucker of the World Futurist Society. He's the senior editor of their magazine, The Futurist, and we are talking about the future. What about the job market? What about medicine? How will we communicate? What will privacy issues look like in the future? All these questions we're talking about with Patrick Tucker of the World Futurist Society. And the question we're going to ask today is, what kind of life will our grandkids and great-grandkids live in the year 2100? Well, with us today is Patrick Tucker of the World Futurist Society, perhaps the leading organization in the United States that tries to look into its crystal ball, consulting with scientists, engineers, doctors about what the future may or may not bring. So, Patrick, glad you could be on Exploration.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
And the first question is, how did you, as a self-respecting person, decide to get into something like futurology and futurism? Most little kids want to become astronauts or firemen or what have you. How did you get into future studies?
Well, I, as a kid, really liked writing stories about science fiction. And the more you get into that, the more time you spend looking at other people that have written science fiction. And, of course, there's a great broad spectrum of people that live in that genre. And what I noticed is that among people like Isaac Asimov and others, people that were interested in science, more so than necessarily sort of social scenarios, they were actually able to telegraph a lot of really interesting things. H.G. Wells, for instance, in some of his earliest writings, was able to forecast, to a large extent, stuff like moving sidewalks. And, of course, Isaac Asimov was one of the first writers to see potential uses of collecting of satellites as solar collectors. And he spent he's most credited with his great work on robots and how robots would interact with people. So I looked at that, and I realized that the future is something that we make all of the time. We spend a ton of our time thinking about it. In fact, recent studies show that we're thinking about the future even when we don't realize it. But a lot of that time that we spend thinking about the future, we're not putting to productive use. And so I wanted to see how I could spend the time that I spent thinking about the future more productively and just get better and better at it.
And perhaps one of the most spectacular predictions was made by H.G. Wells, who actually predicted the atomic bomb and made a prediction about when an atomic scientist would get the secret of the atomic bomb. And that inspired Leo Szilard to come out with the chain reaction and then to write a letter to Albert Einstein, who then wrote a letter to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and the rest is history. And also, tell us a little bit about the World Future Society.
Well, the World Future Society is the publisher of the Futurist magazine, where I serve as a senior editor. And the Society and the Futurist have strived over the years to do one thing and to excel at it, and that is to serve as a neutral clearinghouse of ideas on the future. So we allow thinkers and political personalities and scientists to share in a very informed and serious dialogue about what the future could be like. And we do this in a couple of ways. We've got a website. It's www.wfs.org, as in World Future Society.org. We hold a conference every year. The next one is going to be in Vancouver in July on the 8th. And we hope you can make it. And through the Futurist magazine, which talks to scientists and lay people and anybody that's got a fantastic future-changing idea, and we try to get at the heart of that idea and what it could mean for life here on Earth as it evolves over the next 20, 30, and 50 years.
Okay, well, let's get right into it. First of all, computers. Computers have been galloping at, doubling every 18 months. That's Moore's Law. And some people think that in the future, computers could disappear. But what are your thoughts? What are your thoughts about the future of the computer?
Well, ubiquitous computing and computing, more and more computing power being everywhere, is part of it's an example of what seems like the future that's actually part of the present. We are totally inundated with computer-generated information. If you recorded all human communication from the dawn of time until the year 2003, it would take up about 5 million gigabytes of storage space. And that's as much information as we now create every 2 days. So right now, much of that computer-generated information is stuff you see. It's 900,000 blog posts. It's 50 million tweets. It's 60 million Facebook status updates. And all of that is visible. But in the future, more and more of it is going to be invisible. And that's the sort of stuff that we're creating in greater abundance. Like when you swipe your MetroCard to get on the New York subway, you're creating data about where you live and what time you leave the house. And right now, there's very few people that use that data to any positive effect. I mean, it's just sort of stuck in a system somewhere, and maybe Metro gets around to doing something with it. But imagine a future in the next 10 or 20 or 30 years where all of the little bits of data that you create almost unconsciously when you swipe your magnetic access card to get into your building, when you get off the train in Washington, D.C., and you leave a record of when you got on and when you got off and what you like to see. Imagine all of that being used to predict patterns of behaviors for millions of people so that resources could be allocated more efficiently to where people actually use them. You know, Google CEO Eric Schmidt said that the perfect search engine is something that anticipates what you're going to search for before you search it. So take that same principle, apply it to the future of computers as they exist outside in three-dimensional space, not just in the box on your desk, and imagine coming into contact with cars and stores and weight scales and other objects that are actually working with other objects to anticipate your needs and deliver what you want before you know you want it.
Okay, well, let's take it apart one at a time. Mention cars, and in the future, won't cars literally drive themselves?
Well, self-driving cars are actually already here. In 2007, the third competition of the DARPA Grand Challenge, they hold a self-driving car competition from time to time since 2005, they showed that a car without a driver could navigate 60 miles of urban area in less than 6 hours while obeying all the traffic laws and regulations. The winner was a joint effort by Carnegie Mellon University and General Motors. So 60 miles in 6 hours doesn't sound like much, but it's a huge improvement over the original self-driving robot that MIT was working with in 1979. which needed 6 hours to travel just 1 meter. You can see how far we've come since then. There's a lot of firms like Boston Dynamics and Stanford, and of course iRobot, which is Rodney Brooks's corporation, that makes self-driving vehicles to some extent, and they're used right now in by the military, mostly in an experimental setting, not so much in a battlefield. But this is something that the military is looking to do with drone technology, is leverage it less towards sort of combat operations and more towards transport, things like that, and supply side things. So I think you're going to see self-driving cars moving objects and moving supplies in a civilian setting long before you're going to see cars actually driving people, because cars can move objects and supplies without a human driver pretty easily. But when you tell the car's computer that it's all of a sudden got to think about the needs and all of the different weaknesses of the pushy, demanding little organism in the back seat that is the human, you increase the complexity level of that job exponentially.
Okay, so if cars begin to drive themselves, what about the house when you come home? What's the home going to look like? Are you going to be able to talk to the walls and basically have the walls become intelligent?
Well, this is something that a lot of different labs have been looking at, how to make, what does it mean to have a smart house? And a lot of people say, yes, that what you want in a smart house is a house that interacts with you through sensors, through different interfaces that you're coming in contact with. So you walk into a bathroom, for instance, and your bathroom mirror reads a lot of your reads your weight, but it's also looking at your protein levels, your sodium levels, your vitamin levels, and it's going to give you a recommendation about what you should eat over the course of the day, and that's before you even leave the house. All that information is something that your mirror or your sink or your bathroom floor is able to pick up and tell you about. But there are other ideas for a smart house, too. The Georgia Tech smart house is one where it's mostly for older people, but it records what you do as you go about your day. So if you forgot where you put something or if you need help, the house picks up on it, and they can show you a little movie of where you put the object that you laid down somewhere. And if you need help, then it picks up on that as well, and it can contact your family or it can contact a medical service provider and let them know. They can even monitor the levels of pollen and other particulate matter in your house so that you know that the particulate matter in your house or the pollen is a little high and you should go outside for a walk.
I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our special guest today is Patrick Tucker of the World Future Society, and we are talking about the future. And once again, my latest book is called Physics of the Future, a New York Times bestseller, and a book that we're going to be using as a fundraiser to make sure that your public or community radio station is alive, healthy, and well. So stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration, as we continue our discussion about the future. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Welcome back. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a dialogue with Patrick Tucker of the World Futurist Society, and in this hour, we're talking about the future, your future, the next 10, 20, 50, the next 100 years. And that's the theme of my latest book, Physics of the Future, now a New York Times bestseller, we're talking about what kinds of therapies, technologies, devices, gadgets, what kinds of innovations are going to change the way that we play, the way that we work, the way that we interact with each other. And so once again, in this hour, we're talking about the future, your future, based on interviews that I've conducted with over 300 of the world's top scientists, including our guest today, Patrick Tucker of the World Future Society. Okay, now some people think that when you relax, you'll simply put on contact lenses, which will have the internet, and you'll be able to simply download any movie, download what's happening at the office. You can word process just in the privacy of your room because you have basically the entire internet in your contact lens. Could you elaborate?
This is also it's a really interesting idea that you can put a contact lens or some sort of special glasses on and just sort of envelop yourself in another world. And no one is quite sure yet how to do it. There's University of Washington prototype design for LEDs embedded in a contact lens that you can look at, and you can sort of get light displays. But making the image that small is still something that's really hard. I think that first you're going to see special glasses that you can put on and get a sort of visual readout of. And we're actually going to be hopefully debuting a set of those at the conference in July in Vancouver. It's a Motorola headset, and it's got a little sort of viewfinder type apparatus on the side, and you look through it, and you can watch movies sort of play out like that. But in the future, I don't see any reason necessarily why you wouldn't be able to take a pair of contact lenses that had the same technology as you see in a flat screen, but on a much smaller scale, possibly on a nanoscale, and stick them in your eyes with a pair of headphones and be watching a movie while it looks like you're paying very close attention to whoever you're talking to.
And won't it be somewhat similar to the holodeck of Star Trek or maybe even The Matrix, being able to recreate objects all around you? You couldn't touch them, of course, because they're just images inside your contact lens. But you could resurrect the whole Roman Empire right in your living room, right?
Well, you could. You would. You might need to wear sort of special gloves that would be measuring your hand movements. But this is also something that people are beginning to work with now. And one of the uses of these special gloves that sense touch and. They use that data the way you, when you operate a mouse, collects data about the movement of the mouse, and it turns it into a display change. There are gloves that do the same thing, and people use them in New York during disco shows to make interesting light shows and things like that. And I think that there'll be tremendous demand for them. The technology isn't particularly advanced at all. And one of the great things about it is it gets you out of your chair. So you can operate, I mean, the entire world sort of becomes your interface. So you can create graphics and create displays and manipulate data and open email with a wave of your hand wherever you are, and it gets you up and moving. So I think there'll be tremendous demand for them, and I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing those sorts of objects on the market fairly soon.
Now, you mentioned the smart house and the fact that your bathroom will be able to sense your the state of your body fluids, and give you a readout of your health. But couldn't it also give you the first indication that there's a cancer growing inside your body? Cancer cells emit proteins, enzymes, certain markers that can be detected by what are called DNA chips. Chips made by Silicon Valley that home in on not data, but individual proteins and enzymes and cells. Now, if that's true, couldn't your toilet actually alert you to the presence of a cancer colony that in 10 years could become a tumor, and the word tumor could disappear from the English language?
Well, I certainly hope so. Right now, if you care to put a microchip actually inside your body instead of through an interface like a bathroom mirror, I don't think that would necessarily be hard to do. Whether or not that chip was able to catch the proteins in advance is a different subject. But I've got a friend who he has a microchip in his chest, and it monitors his heart rate. It's not a pacemaker. It doesn't send a jolt of electricity to the heart if there's a cardiac irregularity. It's actually monitoring his heartbeat and sending that information to his cardiologist, and so his cardiologist can check it on a phone. So there's no reason why you couldn't have the same thing to monitor, say, abnormalities in protein levels and send that to a, if you were, say, a cancer survivor and you were worried about getting a protein buildup that might turn into a polyp or something like that, have that information sent to your cancer doctor so then they could have that information with them all the time. It's not a huge leap in the technology. It's really a question of usage. How much monitoring equipment do we want near us all the time? Right now we're a little resistant to the idea of little devices monitoring what we do and sending that information somewhere, collecting it, and broadcasting it to the world. But as we begin to realize the benefits of constant health monitoring and early prevention and early detection of things like cancer, like you said, I think that you're going to see much more demand for those types of monitoring services. And they could theoretically be external to the body. I don't see a reason why they couldn't, but no one has yet made a device that can pick up protein levels that aren't, that isn't physically attached to the organism that it's monitoring.
Well, if you have a smart toilet with DNA chips in it, yeah, capable of picking up enzymes, proteins, even individual cancer cells, that could really change the way we view cancer. Take a look at Aretha Franklin. She has pancreatic cancer. Steve Jobs has pancreatic cancer. And usually it's thought to be very aggressive, inevitably fatal after a few years. But then scientists analyzed it and found out that it's the opposite. It takes about 20 years for pancreatic cancer to grow. And only in the last few years do you feel it and you go to the doctor. So we could be witnessing a revolution in cancer therapy, right? If you get advanced warning, 20 years warning that you might get pancreatic cancer.
Yes, and in that instance, I guess that the sensor would be looking at basically your stool sample and letting you know, reminding you of what you've eaten and what's inside your body right after the fact. And this is the thing that we're discovering about a lot of the illnesses that we treat and we run across on a daily basis, is that they're with us for a long time. And when your method of detecting that stuff is to go into a doctor's office once a year or twice a year, then you really increase the chances of missing something. But when you can, if you've got a device in your house that can take those sorts of measurements for you constantly and alert you, the second there's an abnormality, you can catch it much quicker. And this is the sort of stuff that we're going to use to be much healthier. And this is part of the reason why many futurists predict that we're going to weed out these illnesses like cancer, like perhaps even Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, and we're going to live and be much healthier in the future and live a great deal longer. Some people say that we can live perhaps as long as 300 years with the aid of technology and various nanotechnologies. So we'll be living much longer than we are today. I think that the natural lifespan of the human body, pushed to its furthest extent, without a technology to sort of augment human life functioning, is about 150 years. But that's not necessarily the limit when you bring in technologies like nanotechnology.
Okay. Well, let's finish up the train of thought that we had before on cancer. I heard that recently you can put DNA chips in your bathroom mirror so that you blow on the mirror. You just say, ha, to the mirror. It picks up water droplets and looks for a mutated P53 gene, which is implicated in 50% of all common cancers. And instead of waiting weeks, within a matter of minutes, your bathroom mirror will tell you whether or not you have lung cancer. So this is going to change everything, right? Every time you go to the bathroom without even thinking about it, you just do your normal daily affairs, your bathroom will tell you that you have to watch out for lung cancer in the coming years.
Right. So you... you've got a bathroom mirror that you're interacting with. You've got also a scale. You possibly have items in your house that you drink out of that are collecting different samples from your body that way. And, yeah, you're going to know what's going on in your body a lot sooner than anybody else. And this is going to, I think, really empower people to take a different direction in their health, because you know, the warning from your bathroom mirror not to smoke or, you know, to regulate your diet a little bit better or to get exercise is useless if you don't follow the advice. But with that daily reminder, I think you're going to start seeing changes in behavior in people. And you're going to start seeing people getting more regular checkups because, I mean, you don't necessarily have early onset cancer because your bathroom mirror tells you so. But if your bathroom mirror tells you so, you're much more likely to go in and get a regular screen. And that's what's going to help catch the cancer early and catch, you know, other diseases and abnormalities early. So it's really about sensors that we already have, making them, using them in different places and collecting data about the human body on a constant daily basis and then leveraging that information to help people know what's going on with them a lot sooner so they can take preventative action a lot earlier. And that does change everything. That improves the human lifespan.
Okay. And talk about increasing the lifespan of humans. We talked about cancers. Now let's talk about organ replacement and growing organs of the body so that we will not die of organ failure. So right now at Wake Forest University, scientists there can take cells of your own body and grow noses, ears, skin, blood, blood vessels, heart valves, bladders, windpipes now, and maybe even livers and the pancreas in the coming years. So do you foresee a time in the coming decades when we're going to have a human body shop? And as organs begin to wear out, we'll simply replace them, and that alone will begin to increase the human lifespan.
Oh, absolutely. You know, earlier this year at the TED conference in California, a doctor brought out a device and was able to actually, in talking to a large auditorium of people, print a human kidney on stage. So, I mean, they printed it the same way when you print a document, you're layering ink on top of paper. This device layers cells on top of cells in a pattern that, in the end, manifests in a kidney that could be surgically implanted in someone tomorrow. It's not necessarily going to match that person's DNA because that was just an example. But this technology really is already here. And so what you see is a lot of people that before would have trouble getting organ donations, suddenly their lifespan and their health outcomes really open up tremendously. But this is something that, though not in wide use, really is in the present already. It's really marvelous stuff. We're able to do this because we have a much better understanding about how to link these sorts of how to create genetically and blood-friendly organs for immediate implantation. We've gotten much better at that. We're much better at creating objects that the body isn't going to reject and helping people through the process of getting their body to accept foreign organs and things like that. And we're much better at using biological material to create more biological material that is useful. And that only increases in the next 10 to 20 years and helps us live a lot longer.
Okay, Patrick, we talked about the smart house, computers of the future. We talked about medicine and how your bathroom will have more computer power than a modern university hospital. And now let's talk about robots. We are brainwashed by Hollywood into thinking that thinking, scheming, devious robots are just around the corner. Skynet is going to become conscious, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, the robot, is going to be unleashed on humanity. But tell us a little bit about robots today, where we really are with respect to creating automata, machines that can think by themselves. And let's now think about the next 50 to 100 years. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that, you know, robot development is proceeding a lot faster than many people thought it would. But if you talk to roboticists, one of their main concerns is that people have put too much faith in these devices to act autonomously. Because as you pointed out, they are they're wondrous machines and they're able to do a lot of things a lot better than they used to. But they are still dumb machines. There's two tracks of robot development in many ways. There's the type of robot or artificial intelligence that you saw on Jeopardy with Watson, and this is a computer that's been programmed to execute a really difficult command, which is playing Jeopardy and understanding and parsing nuances in language, and understanding a bit about the way humans speak and taking that information and dialoguing with a huge storehouse of information to basically beat humans at what is considered an extremely human game, which is Jeopardy. And as everyone who saw Watson win on Jeopardy knows, that the performance was really quite remarkable and represents a huge improvement over where artificial intelligence was a couple of years ago. But this is still a limited artificial intelligence. This, Watson's not necessarily going to compete with you for your job. After Deep Blue, which was Watson's predecessor, another IBM artificial intelligence computer program, beat Garry Kasparov in chess in the 80s, the literary critic George Plimpton had a wonderful observation. He said, yeah, that thing's great at chess, but it can't hail a cab to get out of the hotel room. It's not going to help you with a bad marriage. And the same is true with Watson. So that's a particular type of artificial intelligence, and it's limited to performing perhaps extremely complex tasks really well, but it may not know as much about the real world as it seems to, or that we think that it does.
Now, Patrick, this Watson computer, wasn't it so stupid that it didn't even know that it won? You couldn't congratulate it. You couldn't say, wow, you just won this contest against two humans. Isn't this basically just a very sophisticated adding machine?
Well, I think that you can certainly say that it's a lot cooler than an adding machine, but no, it couldn't understand the concept of winning. It's not going to know meaningfully what it means to sort of conquer this particular conquest. There's no consequence for it. It just executes a program. So yes, I mean, it's a fantastic adding machine. The more interesting work in robotics and artificial intelligence, from my perspective, is actually taking place in Japan, where they're from which I just returned. They're spending a lot of time trying to create robots that interact with people and in many ways do a lot of the functions in three-dimensional space that people do. Now, the robots right now are still extremely rudimentary. They've got a robot that can fold laundry, and they've got robots that can do interesting traditional Japanese dances, and it's still really rudimentary, but that avenue of robotic development where you're forcing the robot to interact with three-dimensional space, I think is going to be the much more lucrative one, because that's how our brains developed. We developed our brain to perceive patterns in three-dimensional space, avoid threats, and seek out opportunities. And so in Japan, one thing that they're really focused on is getting robots to sort of navigate the same things, because they have a very elderly population, and they hope that robots will be able to help elderly people in their homes to do more things. But that avenue of research is yielding some really remarkable results. These are still, of course, dumb machines, but you can see them learning more about the actual world than I think you would see in a machine like Watson, which has been programmed with all the information that it has.
Okay, well, let's talk about these two kinds of robots. First of all, the first type of robot is sometimes called an expert system. It mm-hmm. has a lot of facts, just a lot of facts. It can't reason, it can't come to conclusions. It can't do anything that we associate with thinking, but it's very good at correlating facts and giving you answers for well-defined questions. So, some people think that one day we're going to have RoboDoc or RoboLawyer. We'll simply talk to the wall, an animated image of a doctor or lawyer will appear. You'll ask questions in a stylized format, and 95-99% of the time, common questions will get an accurate answer. So do you foresee a time when the descendants of Watson eventually become our expert companions that can answer questions like in medicine, in law, and things like that?
Well, I think that a lot of people are already using search engines like Google as their expert companion. And this is a form of, in many ways, an expert system that's just an algorithm. The data that it's giving is data that's been human supplied, but we still trust it as though it were checked and the result of a thought process that is objective, when, of course, it isn't. So I think that there's a lot of room for different expert systems to perhaps make many different professions obsolete as we understand them today. These expert systems, they're also sometimes called narrow artificial intelligences, because they are artificially intelligent, but only along in a very narrow definition. They're only good at one particular thing. they are incapable of stuff like creativity or thinking sort of outside of the box. So you might be able to use them as a reference, and they'll be a fantastic reference, and we can this will save a lot of time that we would otherwise spend looking things up or searching through, for instance, Google search engine results for the correct answer. That process is going to get a lot easier because of these expert systems. But they're not going – if you ask them to sort of speculate about the meaning of something, they might not give you the answer that's going to be optimal. I think that at least for the next 50 years, you're still going to need to take that data and ask a real expert about what it might mean and how they might use it or how you might use it most productively in order to get your best answer.
Yeah, some people think that perhaps 90% of the visits to the doctor and to the hospital are just for small little menial things, but they rack up a huge bill when you simply add up all the hours devoted to it. And that's where RoboDoc and RoboLawyer come in, not for the specialized cases involving very sophisticated use of surgery and high tech, but just for the day-to-day coughs and the day-to-day fevers and the day-to-day things that drive many people to the hospital and to the doctor's office. And now speaking about the second kind of robot, you touched upon something. The Japanese population is aging faster than any other population on the planet Earth right now. Birth rates are plunging down to about 1.2 children per family. Almost no immigration into Japan is taking place. And so aren't we seeing basically an enormous push into robotics to create robot nurses to take care of a very aging population?
Yes, yes, you are. And nursing is one potential use of these robots. In the interim, I think they're looking at them more sort of like companions, sort of like maids. But ultimately, they will have to perform very low-level sort of medical tasks. And the robotic development and robotic research in Japan is different from the United States in a couple of respects. On the one hand, as you mentioned, there's tremendous demographic need. They are the oldest population on the planet demographically, with the exception of Monaco, which doesn't exactly count, I don't think. And so there's tremendous need for servants in houses that can do little things that people who are old used to be able to do fairly well but can't anymore. The work situation in Japan is such that people are really expected to be to work. There's no working from home isn't something socially that's nearly as acceptable as it is in the United States. But more importantly, robotic development in Japan is funded not by the military as it is in the United States. I mean, there are private companies that do robotic development in the States, but a lot of the money going into that development is military money. In Japan, a lot of that money comes from grants. It comes from the government, but not through the military, and it comes from big corporations. And so the field of robotic research is open in a different way. I talked to a robotic researcher over there. His name is Dylan Gass. He works with the Advanced Telecommunications Research Institute. And he pointed out that they have a very different legal system over there as well, so you can actually put people and robots together, like actual civilians, regular people that like go out and walk around malls and drive cars. And, you know, you and I, we're going to have a much, much higher likelihood of being able to interact with a robot in Japan than we would in the United States, because here, if you want to put a robot, for instance, in a mall, you need a lot of permits and you could get sued if one of the actuators misfires and, you know, you've got a hydraulic pump going, you know, moving towards somebody's head at 200 miles an hour. That's a lawsuit. Whereas in Japan, people are much more likely to, the legal environment is such that you don't have to worry as much about lawsuits. So they're running a really interesting experiment over there where they have a bunch of robots in Osaka shopping mall. They just concluded this experiment in December. And if you walk through the mall, the robot takes a look at how fast you're walking, whether you're lingering by the windows, whether you're lingering by the map, and what your body language seems to be. They pick up all this information from a network of sensors that are placed around this particular area, and based on the information that it receives, it makes a determination about whether or not you're safe to approach or whether you're in a hurry. And if you're safe to approach, the robot walks up to you and gives you directions about or makes a recommendation for a shop that you might like to see. It's exactly the sort of thing that you wouldn't find in the United States for legal reasons, but in Japan you can run an experiment like that, and it's really quite fascinating. And this is why I think the greatest strides that we're going to see in robotics are going to be based out of Japan in the next 10 or 20 years?
Well, Patrick, we talked about robots, and now let's talk about science fiction. Sometime in the future, some people think that robots may take over. Maybe they'll become smarter than us. Maybe they'll put us in zoos. Maybe they'll throw peanuts at us, make us dance behind bars, just like we make bears dance behind bars. Other people say that, well, let them take over. They are our children. It's the natural progress of evolution, survival of the fittest. And if they're fitter than us, well, they are our children. And if they put us to rest, so be it. Well, what are your thoughts? You probably get a lot of different thoughts from all directions. First of all, tell us, what is the singularity, and what do you think is going to actually happen?
Well, the singularity is a term from physics. We're pointing to an event horizon where, because of an accelerating event, there's a point where you can multiply something over and over and over again, and for a number of cycles in that multiplication, you get very low numbers, but you reach a point where the multiplying a number by over and over again, you suddenly get really large numbers. And this concept has been applied to that's in math, and in physics, it's an event horizon. It's a really complex idea, but it's been applied to an idea of technological acceleration. So our technological information. According to thinkers like Ray Kurzweil and before him Werner Vinge, the amount of technological information that we have about the world, they argue, doesn't proceed by way of addition. We don't add development on top of development. It actually proceeds, they say, exponentially. So every technological development produces, say, five, and then each of those produces, say, another five little breakthroughs that we don't recognize as such right away or don't recognize as connected, but they are. And they argue that because of that, the amount of technological innovation that we are going to see over the course of the next 20 years will be equal to the amount of technological innovation that we perceived in the last 100 years.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest was Patrick Tucker of the World Future Society. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And once again, we are offering my book, Physics of the Future, as a premium on many public and community radio stations to raise funds to keep their voice alive and well. Good day.